Welcome to Chemistry of the Mind, Unlocking the Brain's Secrets. Today, we're diving deep into the fascinating world of oxytocin.
A hormone, a neuropeptide. It's often called the love hormone, though that's a bit of an oversimplification, isn't it?
Exactly. It's involved in so much more than just romantic love. Childbirth, maternal bonding, even milk production. It's a key player in a whole suite of social behaviors.
And it's been around for a long time, hasn't it? Evolutionarily speaking, I mean.
Oh, absolutely. Present in animals since the early stages of evolution shows you how fundamental it is to, well, life.
It's amazing how one molecule can have such diverse effects, from uterine contractions during labor to complex social interactions.
It really is, and the way it works is fascinating, this positive feedback loop.
Right, where the initial release of oxytocin triggers even more production and release, like a snowball effect.
Precisely. Think of childbirth, for example. A contraction starts, oxytocin is released, which intensifies the contractions, leading to more oxytocin and so on, until, well, the baby's born.
It's a remarkably efficient system. And we see the same thing during lactation and sexual activity too, a cascade of oxytocin.
Now let's talk about the science behind this. Oxytocin is actually derived from a larger precursor protein, encoded by the OXT gene.
And that precursor protein is broken down enzymatically, eventually releasing the active oxytocin nonapeptide, right?
Yes. A series of enzymes work to progressively hydrolyze the precursor protein into smaller and smaller fragments. The final step is catalyzed by peptidylglycine alpha-amidating monoxygenase, or PM.
And interestingly, PAM's activity relies on vitamin C, so there's a link between vitamin C intake and oxytocin production?
There is evidence to suggest that yes. Sodium ascorbate has been shown to stimulate oxytocin production in ovarian tissue. It's a complex interplay of factors.
It's remarkable how interconnected these systems are. And then there's the breakdown of oxytocin by oxytocinase.
Another layer of regulation. And various substances like amistatin and bestatin can inhibit this degradation, although they also affect other peptides like vasopressin.
Speaking of vasopressin, the structural similarities between oxytocin and vasopressin are striking. Just a couple of amino acid substitutions make all the difference.
It's a testament to the elegance of biochemistry. Small changes can have huge functional consequences. And Vincent Duvigneau, who first synthesized oxytocin.
A landmark achievement. He won the Nobel Prize for that work in 1955, if I recall correctly.
Indeed. And the work of Iphigenia Fataki in the following decade further advanced our understanding of oxytocin synthesis and its analogs. Now, where is oxytocin produced in the body?
Primarily in the hypothalamus, specifically in the supraoptic and paraventricular nuclei. It's then stored in herring bodies at the axon terminals in the posterior pituitary, ready for release into the bloodstream.
But it's not just the pituitary, right? We find oxytocin in other parts of the body as well.
Absolutely. In the corpus luteum and placenta in females, the interstitial cells of Leydig in males, and even in the retina, adrenal medulla, thymus, and pancreas in both sexes, it really raises questions about its role in these diverse tissues.
And it's fascinating how, in some species, certain cells outside the brain can actually produce oxytocin themselves, like Leydig cells in rats and guinea pigs.
It highlights how much we still have to learn about this remarkable hormone. Its involvement in everything from reproduction to social behavior is so complex.
So we've talked about oxytocin's role in social bonding, but it's so much more complex than just a love hormone, isn't it?
Oh, absolutely. It's involved in pain relief, for instance, acting on opioid receptors. Who knew?
Yeah, it's fascinating. And the way it works in the brain is intricate, with specific neurons releasing it, not just the pituitary gland.
Right, and those receptors, they're all over the place. Amygdala, hypothalamus, brainstem, even the spinal cord.
It really highlights how widespread its influence is. And the distribution changes throughout development, too. Even after childbirth, things shift.
Like in the montane vole, right? Fascinating how these things adapt.
Exactly. And then there's the whole in-group, out-group dynamic. It's not always about lovey-dovey feelings.
Yeah, the study in the Netherlands with the increased national pride and decreased acceptance of foreigners, that was a bit unsettling, wasn't it?
It does make you think. Oxytocin seems to amplify existing social biases, not just create positive connections.
It's like it strengthens whatever social framework is already there, good or bad. It's a powerful modulator.
Definitely. And it's not just about behavior. Oxytocin has a real impact on how we perceive threats and process fear.
Like that study where it enhanced the recognition of fear expressions? That's a pretty significant effect.
It is, and it even seems to play a role in how social memories are formed and maintained.
So it's not just about the immediate reaction, but also how those experiences shape future behavior.
Precisely. And we're still learning about its role in mental health, like depression.
There's evidence it has antidepressant-like effects, but the mechanism isn't fully understood, is it?
Not entirely. It might involve vasopressin receptors, too. It's a complex puzzle.
It really is. And then you have the differences between males and females, how estrogen and testosterone influence oxytocin's effects.
It adds another layer of complexity. Females seem to respond more strongly to social stimuli after oxytocin administration.
And their amygdala activity increases in response to threats, while males don't show the same effect. Interesting.
It is. It suggests a deeper interplay between hormones and social behavior, which is fascinating to explore. And the chemical structure itself, a nonapeptide with a disulfide bridge. Remarkable how such a small molecule can have such a profound impact.
It really is. And the variations in that structure, like in marmosets and tanarins with the pro-8-OT, it shows how evolution has tinkered with this molecule over time.
So we were talking about the fascinating complexity of oxytocin. And its role isn't limited to just social bonding, right? It's a much bigger player in the body's overall functioning.
Oh, absolutely. It's involved in so many processes, from childbirth and lactation to pain relief and even aspects of mental health. It's truly remarkable.
It really is. And its synthesis, the work of Vincent de Veneau, a landmark achievement, wouldn't you say?
Absolutely groundbreaking. Winning the Nobel Prize in 1955 for synthesizing a polypeptide hormone like oxytocin, that's a huge deal. And vasopressin, too, synthesized in the same year, both released by the posterior pituitary.
Though it's worth noting, oxytocin neurons produce other peptides that act locally, like corticotropin-releasing hormone and dynorphin. It's not just about these long-distance hormones.
Right, and the fact that these magnocellular neurosecretory cells, the ones producing oxytocin and vasopressin, are right next to each other, that's got to be significant, doesn't it? Their proximity suggests some sort of interplay, maybe even coordinated release.
It's certainly a point of ongoing research. And speaking of research, the potential of small molecule oxytocin receptor agonists like LITO1, that's an exciting area for treating social deficits, perhaps even in conditions like autism.
It is. Think of the possibilities if we could effectively target those receptors. But social behavior itself, it's such a complex interplay of individual and environmental factors.
It is. It's like this constant exchange, a give and take influenced by both internal qualities and external pressures.
Yeah, and communication is at the heart of it all, isn't it? It's fundamental for survival and reproduction, driving so much of our social interaction.
Absolutely. And the dual systems model, the idea of reflective versus impulsive determinants of social behavior, that adds another layer of complexity. Sometimes we act with clear intent, other times it's pure impulse.
Exactly. It's this push and pull between conscious thought and, well, gut reactions. And then there's the difference between mundane social behavior, the everyday interactions, and defensive behavior, those impulsive responses to conflict. It's fascinating how it all plays out.
It really is. And how it develops over time, from infancy to old age, influenced by both biology and environment. It's a lifelong journey of social learning and adaptation.
Yeah, and culture plays a huge role, shaping a child's social landscape from the very beginning. The settings they're exposed to, the people they interact with, it all leaves a mark.
It does. And emotions are so intertwined with all of this, aren't they? They're the language of social interaction, the way we understand and respond to each other.
Absolutely. Being able to read emotional cues, to understand another person's perspective, that's essential for navigating the social world. And it develops over time with experience and maturity. It's not just about knowing what to do, but when and how to do it.
Right. It's that constant balancing act between our own needs and the needs of others. And it's not always easy, is it? Especially when you consider the individual differences in how we learn and adapt to social cues.
No, it's not. Some children pick things up quickly, others struggle, and the biological changes throughout life, from prenatal development to old age, they all impact our social interactions. Think about the shift in focus from caregiver to peers in childhood, or the emergence of romantic relationships in adolescence.
It's a constant evolution, isn't it? And then there's the whole in-group, out-group dynamic, the way social structures influence our behavior. It's not always about love and connection. Sometimes it's about competition and exclusion.
Yeah, and the neuroscience of it all, the brain regions involved in social cognition, the paracingulate cortex, the medial prefrontal lobe, the amygdala. It's fascinating how these areas light up when we interact with others.
It is. And the research on brain injuries, how damage to the prefrontal cortex can disrupt social behavior, that really underscores the importance of these neural circuits.
Absolutely. And then there's the hormonal influence, vasopressin's role in affiliation and paternal behavior. It's another piece of the puzzle. It all ties together, this intricate web of biology, psychology, and social interaction. It's fascinating how much we're still learning.
So we've been discussing the fascinating intricacies of social behavior, and it's clear that oxytocin plays a crucial role. But it's not the only player in the game, is it?
Oh, definitely not. We've touched on vasopressin, but there's also serotonin, a key neurotransmitter linked to feelings of social connection. And, a drop in serotonin can actually correlate with social isolation.
That's interesting. So it's not just about the presence of these chemicals, but also the fluctuations in their levels?
Exactly. It's this dynamic interplay that influences how we interact with each other. And positive effect, those good feelings plays a huge role too.
Yep. How so?
Well, studies have shown that positive effect can actually induce more prosocial behaviors, like helping and cooperation. It's like a positive feedback loop. More good feelings lead to good actions, which can then lead to more good feelings.
I see. So it's not just a one-way street. Social behavior influences our emotional state, and our emotional state influences our social behavior. It's a two-way street.
Precisely. And then, of course, there's the impact of electronic media, which has completely reshaped the social landscape.
It's true. It's created these entirely novel situations and interactions, blurring the lines of traditional social settings. Think about it. Gender norms are evolving. Information spreads rapidly. It's a whole new ballgame.
It is. And, politicians can't just tailor their speeches to one audience anymore. Everything's broadcast, translated, shared. Everyone's connected. It's a global village, so to speak.
Right. And this interconnectedness has a ripple effect on our behavior. The way we communicate, the roles we play, it's all in flux.
Absolutely. And then there's the media's influence on both prosocial and aggressive behavior. We see it with violence in movies and video games, but also with positive portrayals that can actually encourage helping behavior.
The general learning model, right? It suggests that what we consume in the media can actually shape our actions, especially over long periods.
Yeah, it can even influence personality traits. It's fascinating, but also a little unsettling, isn't it? Like, how much are we shaped by what we watch and listen to?
It's a valid question. And studies on video games and music back this up. Prosocial games lead to more helping behavior, aggressive music to more aggression. It's a powerful connection.
It is. Even the music played in a restaurant can impact how much people tip. It's remarkable.
It really is. And then there's conformity, that unconscious pressure to align with the group. The larger the group, the stronger the pull, it seems.
Right. It's that need for acceptance or maybe access to information. We're social creatures, after all.
We are. And aggression, while it can have negative consequences, also plays a role in adaptation and survival.
Definitely. And so much of this is tied to communication, both verbal and nonverbal.
Absolutely. Words themselves carry meaning, but it's the nonverbal cues, the coverable behavior, that adds depth and nuance. It's the unspoken language that often speaks volumes.
Yeah, the facial expressions, the body language. It's a whole other layer of communication, although, not everyone agrees on the significance of gestures.
True, but the research on how gestures accompany speech, how they bring inner thoughts to life, it's compelling.
It is, and they develop alongside speech in children, which suggests a deep connection.
Right, and Paul Ekman's work on this, highlighting the challenges of studying these behaviors empirically, it's important work.
Absolutely. And then there are the mental disorders that impact social behavior, like social anxiety disorder, ADHD, and autism spectrum disorder.
It's a complex field, and we're still learning so much. But understanding these factors, the chemical, the social, the psychological, it's crucial for helping people navigate the social world.
It is. And it's fascinating to see how all these pieces fit together. Thanks for joining us on Chemistry of the Mind. We hope you've enjoyed exploring the complexities of oxytocin and social behavior. Until next time, take care.